Indeed, let me join with Brother Johnson in welcoming you into our assembly this morning, that we might be able to worship and praise the God of heaven, that we might be able now to study some from the pages of His will, that it might try to challenge and stimulate us in the things that are right, the things of God, that we might be able to make some practical applications in the lives that we live, and by virtue of doing that, that we might be able to exemplify to the world round about us that indeed Christ Jesus the Lord does live and He dwells within us. It is good for us to be home this morning after having been gone last week, and I want to begin by thanking those who worked in my stead, Brother Johnson in preaching last Lord's Day morning, and Brother John Sellers in the class last Lord's Day morning, and then preaching last Lord's Day evening, and Brother White in taking my class on Wednesday evening. And our efforts in Elizabethtown, Kentucky were very enjoyable. It was an encouraging, uplifting, very stimulating week. It is a church that grew out of the church at Hodgenville, Kentucky. And it's hard for us to imagine that it was 20 years ago that we were working with them. And when we started working with them, there were about 30 of us. If we had 30 both services on a Lord's Day, we just went out elated. If we didn't drop under 30, we thought that was great, because there were only about 34 or 35 of us altogether, and we always had some out of town. If we'd get a few people to visit with us, why, it was just really good. And now to know that the church in Hodgenville has about 70 people, and the church in Elizabethtown runs in the 80s, it means that there's about five times the number of people there than were there when we were there 20 years ago in those two areas. There wasn't a church in Elizabethtown, or at least a sound church, till just a few years ago when some brethren peacefully left the work at Hodgenville and went over there and started that work. It's a larger community, and they have really more potential for growth because of attitudes in that kind of a situation. And there have been more people that have kind of moved in and helped. It's a very young church, and it's full of enthusiasm, and we enjoyed being with them. One of the most unusual things that ever happened during that meeting. We had more people on Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night than they've had all year long at any of those services. And probably the most unusual thing is last Sunday morning we had 95. Their record attendance at any one time, which was the day they met for the very first time and everybody came to give them a boost, was 120. And so to have 95 on a Sunday morning was just great. But last Sunday night, we had 100, and they were just literally thrilled to death. It's very seldom you have more on Sunday night than you ever have on a Sunday morning. And it was just really encouraging. We had 80-some on Wednesday night, and that was just really thrilling. And we averaged about 85 a service, which means it was just about like preaching to a Sunday morning crowd all week long. And it was good to be with people that we've known and loved, see so many people from a variety of other places sometimes during the week that we enjoyed that. But it's good to be back this morning. We're going to study this morning in regard to our children's inheritance. And it may seem unlikely to you, the place from whence we take our reading this morning, but if you will, in the 15th chapter of the book of Luke, Jesus teaches a parable that's very familiar to us, beginning in verse 11. A certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the portion of goods that falleth to me," and he divideth unto them his living. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country, and there wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in the land, and he began to be in want. And he went and joined himself to a citizen of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. And he would fain have filled his belly with the husk that the swine did eat, and no man gave unto him. And when he came to himself, he said, "How many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger? I will arise and go to my father, and I will say unto him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants." And he arose and came to his father. But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him, and had compassion, and ran, and fell on his neck, and kissed him. And the son said unto him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven, and in thy sight, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. But the father said to his servants, Bring forth the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring hither the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and be merry. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found, and they began to be merry. Let me ask you, what are you leaving your children? Here is a father who had something to leave his children. And as a result of that, even though our study this morning is obviously not a study of the parable, nonetheless, there are two conspicuous points in this parable that need to be considered. First of all is the thought in verse 12 that this father did have an inheritance physically to leave those children. And evidently it was understood by those children, the youngest one particularly, who came to his father, and in an unlikely way, before normally that inheritance would have been received, he came in and requested or demanded that portion of the inheritance that was going to be his. And his father gave it to him. He was a wise father. And here a son had to learn a lesson that, regardless evidently of what kind of talk that the father might be able to do, he was not going to be able to dissuade him. And so the younger son received his inheritance and he went out. And he enjoyed it while it was there. He lived it up. He had a good life. And he had all kinds of people round about him. But ultimately the money ran out. And when that ran out, the food ran out, the shelter ran out, the good times ran out, and maybe more important than all of that, all of his so-called friends ran out on him, and there he was, left high and dry. And the only opportunity that he could have at this juncture was to decide that I've got to do something to get at least some kind of sustenance that I might be able not to be in want where hunger is concerned. And he joins himself with a fellow of the country where he is, and while he is there, he is ready to join the feast of those that he is feeding, the swine. And while he's doing that, there's the second important point I want us to see, and that's in verse 17. That while he was there, he came to himself. And notice that when he came to himself, that there were thoughts of home. There was something about the way things were back where Dad was, and the kind of upbringing and the time of youth and childhood that he had spent under the house or the roof of his father that caused him to recognize the vast difference between what he presently had and how he called this life and living and what was at home. And he resolved in very great honesty to make an important decision in his life. He was willing to admit that he was wrong. He was willing to admit that he had sinned not only against heaven but also against his father, and that he was going to go home and tell that to his father. And when he did that, his father received him and embraced him and accepted him. And you're able to see something marvelous in that. Of course, this is a parable that teaches God's great love and concern for the sinner. And there is no more marvelous picture, I guess, of it than this. Here is a man who, with his eyes wide open, went into sin. And yet when he acknowledged sin, God was gracious and willing to receive him back. When this young man came back to his father didn't berate him. He didn't belittle him. While he was yet a long way off, he didn't send a messenger out and say, Listen, beat it. You had your chance. You asked for it. I know what's happened. I can tell by just looking at it. I can tell from the smell of you where you've been. And you're not welcome back here anymore. Just hit the road, Jack. Don't come back. He didn't do that, did he? Instead, he went out and embraced him. And the son made his statement, but the father, he wouldn't have any hearing of it. Instead, he said, No, you're my son, and I'm going to take you back home. And I'm going to clean you up, and I'm going to put new clothes on you. And you can imagine what they probably did with the ones he'd been wearing. And I'm going to put a ring on your hand and shoes on your feet. I'm going to make you characteristic of the station that you belong. I'm not going to hear of your being a servant. And we're going to have a feast because this my son that was dead is alive again. Here's a young man who came to himself because of the influence of the home that he had had or the home life he'd had. And I'm convinced that you and I need to think a little bit about our children's inheritance. Let me ask you, just what is it that you're leaving your children? Everybody here is going to leave some inheritance behind. Some physical inheritance will be left behind. It doesn't matter if it's $500 or $5 million. There's some inheritance physically that all of us at least anticipate is going to be left. And generally what we've done is we've made a will so that we can divide out how it's going to be appropriated among those who are our heirs so that everything can be taken care of. But it's not this kind of a consideration that we make this morning. I want you to think in regard to the most precious things, in regard to the things that are more valuable than just these material things that inevitably are going to pass away anyway. And I want you to think with me, just what are you leaving your children? I want to ask you, are you going to leave your children a good name? Are you leaving them that? The writer of the book of Proverbs, back in the 22nd chapter and in the very first verse, makes a statement that to our society at least is kind of peculiar. He says, a good name is to be chosen rather than great riches. You know, somebody says, how can he say that? Let me ask you, would you rather have a good name or $1 million? I mean, in our society today, with its great emphasis upon materialism and upon financial security and upon wealth, somebody who would say, what would you rather have, a good name or $1 million? It sounds peculiar to even ask that question. I'll take the $1 million any time. That's the philosophy and the thinking of the world. Or if you'll look back again, you'll realize this is not just an isolated thought in the Scriptures. For in the 7th chapter of the book of Ecclesiastes and in verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Notice here again, a good name is better than precious ointment. And in this passage, precious ointment stands for something that is very valuable. And he says that a good name is more valuable than those material things that the world often looks at and sees of great value. You remember when they anointed Jesus for the burial? It was a very precious ointment. Judas was greatly upset. The rest of the apostles were upset. Why wasn't this sold and the money given for the dispersion of the needs of the poor rather than wasted it in the way that this woman wasted it on you, Lord? But you see, that was something that was a very precious commodity. It was costly. And yet again, he says that a good name is better than that. Are you leaving your children a good name? Let me ask you, I'm not suggesting that what you do when you leave them a good name is to make sure they know your heritage and your history and your roots. I'm not even suggesting that you make sure they know how to correctly spell it. You know, it seems to me there's a lot of real common names in America. There's names like Adams and Smith and Jones and Williams. I've always kind of noticed that the name Feist is a rather peculiar name. It's peculiar from the standpoint of the way that it's spelled as well as the way that it's pronounced. And there's not very many of those names around. And I've always noticed that. But it's not this that we're trying to stress in regard to what we're doing, that we make sure that our kids know that it's E before I because it's German in its pronunciation, and in German, when you've got double vowels like that, the last one is the one that's emphasized in its strength rather than the first one, rather than in the fact that in the English it's the opposite of that, and therefore whenever it's looked at from an Americanization standpoint, it's pronounced feast rather than the way that it's actually pronounced feist. That's not the point, and it's not a matter of giving them a lesson so they can teach everybody else when they go off to school somewhere, and especially you get in college and you get all kind of pronunciations of a name like that where everybody knows Smith and Adams and Jones and that, and they never mess those names up. That's not what he's saying. When he talks about a precious name, what we're asking is, what kind of character is associated with your name? What kind of character or reputation in the name that you wear are you leaving for your children? I mean, when people hear your name, do they know that here is somebody whose word is their bond? When they hear your name, do they think, here is one who can be trusted? Here is a good man, or here is a good woman. Here is somebody that you can depend upon. And that all of this is true because you're the kind of neighbor, or you are the kind of father, or you're the kind of mother, you're the kind of leader in your community that people want to be around you. You've got the kind of reputation, you've got the kind of character, you're the quality of person that others want to be around. What kind of name are you leaving your children? I admit there probably isn't, from the standpoint of the thinking of the philosophy of the world, a wealthy person that I'm talking to this morning, even though all of us intend at least to have something to leave our children. But I'll tell you what, even though you may not have much insofar as this world's goods to leave to your heirs, you can leave them a good name. And it's better than anything that money can buy. Oh, it's not wrong to be wealthy. In fact, it's not wrong to have some kind of physical inheritance to leave to your children. But let me suggest to you that we need to be more concerned about making sure that the inheritance we're leaving is the inheritance of a good name rather than just something that is material in its nature. You remember in the 12th chapter of the book of Luke that there was one who came to Jesus in verse 13 and he said, "Master, speak to my brother that he divide the inheritance with me." You know, physical inheritance have this tendency. A tendency sometimes to divide family members and to produce a falling out, that sometimes a rift occurs that is never able to be healed the remainder of life. Some families literally fall out fighting over who's going to get what in an inheritance. And these two fellows are like that. And notice this fellow sees Jesus and his wisdom and his insights and his reputation, and they comes and he says, "Master, you make my brother divide the inheritance with me." And Jesus looks at him and effectively says, "That's not my purpose in life. I didn't come to be a ruler or a judge in matters like this. I came to extend spiritual salvation to the sons of men." And yet he recognizes that here is a major problem that every man has to deal with. And a very familiar statement comes out of the request that this man made in Luke 12, doesn't it? In verse 15, Jesus says, "Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things that he possesses." You see, Jesus is saying, what do you leave behind? Well, you're going to leave some material things behind, but it may produce this kind of thing. You've got to leave behind some other things that are more valuable, that are more precious than that, like a good name. And then he teaches about the rich farmer and how his was totally in material things. And really, when he got done, he didn't have anything. There wasn't anything that he really left behind that was of worth or of value. We need to consider seriously what we are leaving as an inheritance to our children and whether or not it is a good name. Are you leaving a good name to your children? Having preached here for the time that I have, most of you know that I really don't use a great deal of poetry in the preaching that I do. But in a study like this, every once in a while, it seems to me that there are some things that are very apropos. And in an unlikely place, maybe to find this, let me suggest to you the poem, "Papa's Coming." It's a story about two little boys. And they are entirely different little boys with an entirely different outlook on life. And by the time we get done, you can see why. He swung on the gate and looked down the street, awaiting the sound of familiar feet. Then suddenly came to the sweet child's eyes the marvelous glory of morning skies. For a manly stride with a steady stride drew near to the gate that opened wide. As the boy sprung forward and joyfully cried, "Papa's coming!" The wasted face of a little child looked out of windows with eyes made wild by ghostly shades and falling light, a glimpse of a drunk man in the night. Cursing and reeling from side to side, the poor boy trembled and tried to hide, clung to his mother's skirts and cried, "Papa's coming." Here are two different children being raised by two entirely different fathers with entirely different focal points of life. Let me ask you, what kind of adulthood do you think these two are going to have? What are you leaving your inheritance to your children? Let me ask you something else. Are you leaving them the influence of a godly home? Will that be one of the inheritances that your children's going to have after you've gone and met your reward? In Ephesians chapter 6 and in verse 4, Paul says, "And you fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord." We've got a responsibility here as fathers. Notice that's a particular duty to those of us who are fathers, insofar as parenting is concerned. Oh, it's true, our companion, our wife, the mother shares in that role. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 14, or Titus chapter 2, verses 4 and 5. And in parenting, really, both parents have to play a role. But you know, here Paul stresses the fact, particularly to those of us who are fathers, that we've got to take a hand in the child-rearing responsibilities. And I suggest to you that while some of those things involve maybe some delegation of authority, that we must recognize that there's more to it than just delegating. I've got to do more than delegate the responsibility of child-rearing to my wife. I realize that being the breadwinner and trying to provide an honest living for my family is going to take me out of the home more than it would if I was there all the time. I realize that in the course of the activities of life that that's just the way that it's going to be. But it doesn't mean that I just can wash my hands by saying, well, that's your responsibility. Or maybe I'll come along and I'll say, well, preacher, here they are. They're yours. You train them spiritually. Or maybe to those teachers who back here from the youngest classroom right up to the most aged one that we've got back there, to commit them back there and look at the variety of brethren who try to study and meditate and try to find principles of truth that they can instill in the minds of these children, and look at them and say, I'm going to delegate to you all the responsibility of instilling in them godly principles and the truth of God and the Bible. It's in you. Oh, some of that can be done. But you know, sometimes some fathers have delegated all of their responsibility. And all of a sudden, when a youngster gets about 17 or 18 and he gets to be defiant and rebellious, or maybe he has little use for God or little use for his family, especially maybe his own father, and a father who's done that basically turns around and points the finger at everybody else and says, why didn't you guys do what I asked you to do? This passage says that we've got to take a hand in child rearing. We cannot just delegate all of it out. We've got to be there, and there are some things that we and we alone can do. In fact, I'm convinced that because we're the head of the home, I'm convinced because God has placed primarily in the man the leadership in the home, that it is the primary responsibility of the father to see that that child is taught the Word of God and is effectively led to become a Christian. That when it's all said and done, daddies, it rests on your shoulders and mine in a very major way, especially if we're Christians. That's what God expects out of us. And the kind of conduct in the future that our children are going to have in a great way rests on your shoulders. You're the head of the house. I'm going to tell you, that means more than just saying, I want spaghetti for supper, or whatever it is that we're going to make in our demands. We've got some leadership roles that we've got to fulfill. And God's going to require some answers out of us in these particular things. Are we leaving the influence of a godly home to our children? What kind of memories do your children have? I don't understand, and I freely admit I can't explain why it is that sometimes children of what I believe to be faithful Christians are unfaithful. They go astray. I've seen some that appear to me, at least, and that's all I'm saying, appear to me, as parents to be very good parents. Maybe it was the environment. Maybe it was the pressure group. Maybe it was the pressure that the group put on them. I don't know. Maybe it was other things that entered in. I often don't have an explanation as to why it is that way. But I can tell you this. I've witnessed any number of parents who have been greatly grieved over the fact that their children have turned aside from the Lord. And I don't always know the answer why. But sometimes I do. Sometimes, to a very large extent, the responsibility rests very evenly on the shoulders of the parents. We have failed to provide the influence of a godly home. Again, it's not always that way. I'm sure there are some cases that I think I would know about. It would be just about like the one in Luke 15. I mean, do you get the picture in Luke 15 that the father drove that son out? I mean, do you get the feeling that he was running that farm like some kind of a tyrant, and that this kid just was chafing under the oppression of almost serfdom, that he just had to break away and get his freedom? You don't get that picture at all, do you? And the older brother stays, and he doesn't seem to be dealing with it in that manner either. Sometimes there seems to be some that just feel like they've got to have their freedom, they've got to have their independence, and they want to get away, and they'll do anything to get away. And sometimes they do. And I would suggest that a lot of times it's when a young person goes off to college or goes out here and maybe gets in the military or gets out on their own, because you see, now they're making their own decisions. And when they do that, they're free. And as a result of that, nobody's looking over their shoulder telling them, that's not what you're going to do. You know, sometimes I let my kids make a decision. And they'll make a decision, and I'll say, no, we're not going to do that. No, you're not going to do that. And here's why you're not going to do that. It shows I've got some work to continue to do in helping them to make wise decisions if they would choose something like that. But you see, ultimately, they'll leave home. And when they do, now they're making decisions on their own. And why is it that sometimes when that happens, that they go astray? But in cases where being used or close to a university, somebody maybe would come into the church, maybe they're there, the school's getting ready to start, and you know, they're there with their parents, and they're introduced around and whatnot, and they come maybe a few times, and all of a sudden they drop out of sight, and you never see them again until their parents come back to town. And you know, they come in the door, and they're kind of almost sheepish, and they're embarrassed, and you can almost see their mind rolling, trying to think, what's this preacher's name? I got to remember that. At least he's the one I ought to remember, so that mom and dad will think I'm coming here as much as possible. I've seen that happen. And I've seen the struggle that some young people have had in those situations. I know a young man that when he went off to college, in his freshman year, the first semester, he identified with the congregation of the people of God and worked rather diligently with them. He had a number of talents and was being used in regard to that. But when his second semester started after the break at the new year, why, all of a sudden, at least according to him, you know, he had a class that he had to take on Wednesday night. It was only offered then. He couldn't take it any other time. And he wasn't going to be able to come then. And the next thing you knew, he wasn't coming very much on the Lord's Day either, but he was always going off to see his mother and dad at home. Or he had a girlfriend, you know, and he's going home with her on the weekends. Or he was going home with other friends. And pretty soon it happened just as the way we knew it was going to happen. He just dropped out of sight. And for the next 2 years or a little better, we didn't see him at all. Sometime during the latter portion of the fall of his senior year in that university, one Sunday morning, there he was. And he was back again the next Lord's Day morning, and he renewed his covenant relationship with the Lord, and as far as I know, faithfully, diligently, ardently serves the Lord to this day. What caused him to change? I don't know. He never said. And I never really asked him, but do you know what I kind of suspicion, because I know the home, I kind of suspicion that what happened is about like what happened here in Luke 15. Somehow or another, he came to himself and he started looking at what he was and where he was and saw the difference of a godly home. And he decided that he wanted what he had been brought up in more than what he had chosen. There isn't any guarantee that I can give anybody that the influence of a godly home, even if a child drops out for a while, becomes unfaithful or apostatizes, that they'll ever come back. But I'm going to tell you this, there is a greater likelihood if the inheritance you're leaving your children is the influence of a godly home for them to get like this young man in Luke 15 and to come to themselves and to come back to the Lord and to live that faithful, dedicated life that the Lord would have them to live. Are we leaving them the influence of a godly home? Let me ask you. Will your children remember you as a Christian? As a faithful, dedicated, committed, trusting, obedient, serving, working child of God? Are you leaving them that influence? Will you be remembered for reading the Bible? Will your children remember you as somebody who regularly was found in prayer? Somebody who regularly worshiped the Lord? Will you be remembered as somebody who was interested in the souls of others, that you would do whatever you could to try to talk with others about their soul? Is that the way your children will remember you? Or will you be remembered as somebody who just drug yourself into a service like this? And the truth of the matter is, you were just thrilled to death when it was over with. because you just felt like you punched your time clock for the Lord, and you can go out here now and really live where you want to live, you know, out here in the world with my real friends, doing what I really want to do. Is that the influence? Is that what your children will remember you for? Again, I took a piece of plastic clay and gently fashioned it one day. And as my fingers pressed it still, it moved and yielded to my will. I came again when days were past, the bit of clay was hard at last. The form I gave it still it bore, but I could change that form no more. I took a piece of living clay and gently formed it day by day and molded with my power and art a young child's soft and yielding heart. I came again when days were gone. It was a man I looked upon. He still that early impress wore, and I could change it nevermore. You know, just like clay, kids get hard. When they're young, they're soft and yielding and pliable and teachable. And they'll listen to you because they believe in you and they believe you know everything. Let me share a secret with you. Don't wait till your kids are half grown to start teaching them, because when you're done, you've waited too long. And when you've done that, waiting for them to start making decisions, it's like that hardened piece of clay. It's not going to work. You're not going to shape them or mold them because somebody else has already got in there and done the job for you. When our children are young, when they're small, we need to make sure that we are teaching them diligently. And I'm going to tell you, that's one of the values that's coming up in this Vacation Bible School. It's an opportunity to take young ones and to teach them the marvelous things about the teaching of the Lord in the parables. 5 days. You going to see that your kids are here? Are you going to see that your grandkids are here? Are you going to see that your nieces and nephews are going to be here? I mean, the ones that you can do everything with, you know. You're going to try to get them here? Your kid's going to see you busily involved in everything else? Now, I'm talking about those of you who can be here. But you're not here. You're not in these assemblies. You don't think you need it, or you don't care about it enough to be there. Is that the memory that your kid or grandkid's going to have about you? In regard to those things of the Lord? Will your child remember you as a faithful, dedicated, committed child of God? Last night, my little boy confessed to me some childish wrong. And kneeling at my knee, he prayed with tears, "Dear God, make me a man like Daddy, wise and strong. I know you can." Then while he slept, I knelt beside his bed, confessed my sins, and prayed with low bowed head. Oh God, make me a child like my child here. Guileless, pure, trusting thee with faith complete. I tell you what, more of us who are fathers need to be praying that kind of prayer. More of us who are parents need to be praying that kind of prayer. And I saw something recently as I worked on this that scared me. Do you know that psychologists say that the child's first impression that they have of God is what they see in their father? I thought about it a while and I thought, yeah, I can understand that. After all, here's the authoritarian figure. Here is the all-powerful kind of image. My dad can lick your dad, you know, that kind of thing. And that's exactly the way Scripture portrays God. Let me ask you, fathers, what kind of impression are you leaving of the Father in heaven with your children? What kind of attitude will they have? What kind of picture do they have of God as they see it in you? What kind of example are you leaving? I mean, children are great imitators. You know that as well as I do. How many times, not only because of maybe some physical characteristic, but some action, maybe some word or some phrase or some motion of the body. Somebody looks at somebody that knows their parents well and they say, "Well, I see your mother in you. I see your father in you." Every once in a while, I think I'm living with my mother-in-law. Cherie's got a certain expression that her mother uses when she gets a little flustered, and when she says it, I always said, well, Creola's living here. And I do the same thing like my dad does on a thing or another, and she says, well, looky there, Russell's moved in. You see that in one another, you see that in your kids, and you say those kind of things about others. You know, God said that. He said that to Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 3 and verse 14, and again in the 9th chapter in verse 4. God said to Solomon, be like your father David. Here, God was telling Solomon that your father David is your example. Be like him. Oh, certainly there were some things David did that he didn't want Solomon to do likewise. But in trust, in faith, in his reverence for God, his love for God, in his humility, in his desire to serve and please God, in his commitment to God, in these areas, you be like your father David. Let me ask you, do you want your children to walk in your footsteps? They're probably going to do it. Let me ask you a very sobering question. If right now you died, you may have fooled me. You may have fooled everybody here. You may have fooled the world, period. But you know, and God knows, where you'll dwell eternally. If you died right now, where do you believe you'd be eternally? If you're not a Christian, I'm going to tell you, you're going to be in the fires of hell. Do you really want to turn around, as it were, and look and see standing right beside you your children? You think you're going to find any comfort in that? Do you want them to be there? If that's where you end up, do you want them to be there? I tell you what, you remember the rich man, when he lifted his eyes up being in torment, he got worried about his five brothers, and he said, send somebody back so they won't come to this place. If you get there, you're not going to want anybody else there. How are you living now? Are you living in such a way that they see and will follow in your footsteps as a Christian, as a faithful, dedicated member of the body of Christ? Or will they lift up their eyes being in torment? You know, children are much more consistent sometimes than we are. They'll take it to the logical end when we won't. I talked with a friend of mine here not very long ago, and he was talking about a situation that had developed. He said, you know, a number of years ago, his little girl was in grade school, and she came home one day. And she was all upset, and she said, Daddy, I need to talk to you. And he said, well, sit down, let's talk. And she sat there, and she said, Daddy, Johnny says that his daddy's got beer in the refrigerator at home. And he said, I sat there and looked at her, and he says, well, now, honey, you know that's not so. Johnny's dad's a Christian. You know, they attend where we worship. It's probably the other boys were talking about the things their daddy did. And Johnny didn't want to feel left out. He didn't want to feel isolated. And he wanted to make sure that everybody thought his dad was the same as everybody. And so he probably just saying that. He said, I learned a little while after that, that wasn't so. Dad, Johnny's dad did have beer in the refrigerator. Oh, Johnny's dad opposed drunkenness. But he didn't see anything wrong with a little harmless social drink on occasion when it was necessitated, he said. And he sure had a hard time with some of the teaching that we'd been doing about first things first and about the kinds of things that the Lord would say about things like social drinking. And so as a result of that, finally, his daddy decided, I can find somebody that will approve what I'm doing. I'm tired of feeling like I'm really not what I ought to be. And so he promptly left and joined the denomination. The reason the fellow was telling it, he said, what do you say when somebody comes in and sits down and talks to you, and now the mother has come in, and you see Johnny's not any longer little. Johnny's in the latter portion of his teenage years now. And she came in and she said, preacher, you're going to have to help me. What am I going to do with Johnny? He's been arrested for driving under the influence. I'm going to tell you what, Johnny's dad still says the thing that he says. Drunkenness is wrong, but a social drink, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm going to tell you, Johnny's more consistent than his daddy is. And he's taken it to its logical end, and I'm not surprised. Kids do that. And so we've got to be careful. And you know what our problem is here? Our problem here generally is we're not looking at the right thing. We're losing sight of where we're going. We get out here and we think that if we can get by with it and nobody knows, we don't get caught, that's all that matters. We've lost sight of where we're going. We're living in a society that puts so much in front of us today, and the philosophy is what the eye can see and the hand can hold, and the fun that we can have and the things that we can get into, and we get caught up in the here and the now, and we lose sight of what we're supposed to be and where we're supposed to be going. Do you think the temptations to immorality aren't very strong? Only if you've been living under a rock. God has given us those desires, and he's given us the ability to control the desire, and the problem is we've lost control because we've voluntarily relinquished those things, and we've let our emotions and our desires control us, unless we have developed, like Joseph did, a very strong reason not to engage. Joseph said, I will not sin before, or I will not sin against my God. And that's the way it's got to be. Listen, if the thing that keeps you from doing something wrong is the fact you're afraid the preacher's going to find out, if you're afraid the brethren's going to find out, if you could get in a situation where you could do it and nobody that you knew and nobody you didn't want to know at least would ever find out about it, you'd go ahead and do it. If that's all that keeps you from doing it, you've lost sight of where you're going. And the inheritance that you're leaving your kids in a name and a home and as a Christian is not what it ought to be. It's not very strong. Because we've got to remember God sees, and he's the only one that counts. It doesn't matter if I catch you or not. If God knows it, he's the one, not me, he's the one that's going to finally perform the judgment. And if we can develop the realization that the things that we do are done unto the Lord, it'll help us develop that strong reasoning like Joseph had as to why he wouldn't do some of the things he did. Well, let me see if I can close it up by asking this. Do you really want to go to heaven when you die? Do you really? Being here, that's an unfair question, isn't it? I believe your presence here this morning indicates that's exactly what you want. I can't do this, wish could, for more than one reason. But just suppose I could do this. Just suppose this morning I told you that I am prepared this morning, and I brought my checkbook to do it. I'm prepared this morning, sight unseen, to buy the automobile of every one of you that's brought one here today, that's parked out here in the back lot. And sight unseen, just to be fair, I'm going to pay $50,000 per car. Doesn't matter what shape it's in, doesn't matter how old it is, how young it is, doesn't matter. I'll pay $50,000 per car. How many of you'd be worried about getting over to Duff's right away? Huh? You're not going to be worried about that. We're going to be here a while because there's going to be a line back there while I write the check. I wish I could do that for you. And it would, if I could do it and it'd go right through, tomorrow you'd have the money. Would you sell me your car? Now, wait a minute. I got a second proposal for you. Suppose I tell you this. Will you sell me your car, but will you wait until next Sunday to do it? And I tell you what, to make it worth your while, if you'll sell me your car next Sunday, I'll pay you $250,000 for your car. Would you sell it to me? Oh, condition. There's a condition attached. If you're going to sell it to me next Sunday, you can't move it off the lot. You can't put even one-tenth of a mile on. How many of you'd walk home today? How many of you'd find alternate transportation, not only for today, but for the rest of the week? I mean, it's got to sit there and not be moved, not a fraction of an inch. You move it, I'm not buying it. But if you let it sit there and come back next week, I'll pay you $250,000 for it. How many of you would sell your car? I already know the answer to that. Just everybody here would do that, wouldn't you? We'd somehow get through the week, and we'd do it gladly. Because, let's face it, $250,000, at least in the thinking the world, buys an awful lot of gladness. Now, here's the point. The devil's offering you $50,000 to live right now. He's telling you, live it up. You only go around once in life. Enjoy it. Reach for all the gusto you can. Grab that brass ring and eat, drink, and be merry. There's his $50,000 appeal, and you know what happens? We swallow it hook, line, and sinker. On the other hand, God says if you'll wait and live for me, I'll give you something that's worth more than $250,000. I give you heaven. You know, when I first told you, I'll pay you $50,000 for your car, that sounded pretty good, didn't it? I mean, to most of us here, that sounded pretty good. But it doesn't sound so good after you look at $250,000, does it? Kind of pales. And life lived for the here and now and for the present, and the satisfaction and the delight, the enjoyment of all of the things of this world doesn't seem like much when it's compared to heaven. Have you sold out? Have you sold out to the world and the philosophy of the world? What inheritance are you leaving your children? A good name? A godly home? Or that of a Christian? Let me ask you one more thing. When it comes funeral time, I've conducted a lot of funerals in my life, more it seems than I should. I've learned something. I've learned there's two kinds of funerals. There's the kind I conduct where it's recognized ahead of time. There's no hope that can be offered here. Here's somebody who wasn't a Christian. Here's somebody who's not faithful. Not only did I know it, but some of the people, or maybe the majority of the people gathered together, know it. And I found in those kind of circumstances, there is a sorrow that cannot be comforted. The other kind is the kind that leaves a rich inheritance behind. Oh, they're mourned, and they're lost. And they're, from the standpoint of this world and their attachment to them, and they're loved. But there's the realization that here was somebody who was prepared for a better life. When it comes funeral time, when your kids are standing around at your casket, what are they going to remember about you? What are you going to have left? They're going to stand there and be fussing about whether or not I get the antique clock, or I get the silver, or I get Mom's diamond engagement ring, not you. She told me I could have it. Or are they going to be standing there remembering the character and the reputation and drawing strength after you're gone of the influence of that godly home that has fortified them and sustained them, and the realization that here is one who was a dedicated, faithful servant of the Lord. And I'm just as convinced as I can be, though I'm not the judge, that here's one that's in a better place than they ever had here. And I love them, and I miss them, and I wish they were back. I need them. But I can't do anything else but envy for where they are. What do we think? You're making the decision as to the inheritance that you're leaving your children. If you're here this morning as one who recognizes that the inheritance that you're leaving is not that of a Christian, then what we plead with you is to make that change right now. Peter said to repent and be baptized, every one of you, in the name of Jesus Christ unto the remission of sins, and ye shall receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. If you'll do that, you can leave here this morning a Christian. One who is a possessor of the heavenly inheritance, a rich treasure that you might be able to leave behind an influence for those who follow. If you're a child of God who recognizes your life is not right with God, turn it around right now. What inheritance are you leaving for others behind you? Think about it while we stand and sing.